Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. This is episode 58. I am your host, Ellen. And before I introduce you to our amazing guest today, I have a little challenge for you, or maybe a little exercise, something you might like to try. I have been talking to a number of clients, both groups in organizations and also individual coaching clients recently, about the power of noticing, the power of paying attention. And I think this kind of links to a conversation we had with James Garrett on the show a couple of weeks ago now, about finding our 2.0. Who are we going to be? Who do we want to be if we have the chance to kind of perhaps not reinvent ourselves, but discover who we are at our best, and then really play to that, really enact that, really become that person on a more consistent basis? And if we think of that as our 2.0, how do we go about it? So this is a little practical task for you to try. It's something that I've done, again, with individuals and with groups, particularly lately. And I want you to think about a time in your life, maybe an event or a project or a task or just a period of time that was really satisfying and enjoyable. It was really you at your most alive, or maybe you're at your most at ease or most comfortable, or really in the zone, something that you've done, an experience that you've had where you've really felt like you were operating at your best. It just came easily and naturally, and it was energizing as well as positive, perhaps inspiring or satisfying. Lots of different ways we might describe it. And there's no hard or fast rules. You can't get this stuff wrong. So just have a go. So think about that time, that period, that event or that project, and just reflect on it for a moment. What were you doing? Who was there? Why was it so enjoyable? Why did it give you energy, do you think? What were you doing that perhaps tapped into your superpower? How did it make you feel, both at the time, and also how does it make you feel to reflect on it right now? And then just spend a little bit of time kind of unpacking that, thinking about it. You know, what does that experience or the feelings that come from that experience tell you about yourself? Because it might tell you something a bit about your strengths or your interests or the importance of certain experiences to you as an individual. It might tell you something about the way you interact with people or don't. It might tell you just something about what most energizes and inspires you, because what we know is if we can tap into those feelings more regularly, that contributes to our well-being. But also, if we have to make decisions about how we're going to live our lives, who our 2.0 is going to be, what that's going to look like, then trying to recreate some more of those experiences or take the themes from those experiences and try and recreate those or find opportunities to have those feelings, do those things, use those strengths, engage in those tasks more frequently. If we get the chance to do that, we're going to be living our best life, and surely that's what our 2.0 should be. So a little bit about the power of noticing and reflection, and it links, I think, nicely into today's conversation, which is all about the most incredible possibilities. It's about taking chances. It's about technology, and it's about the power of the mind. Let's listen in. My guest today has a fascinating and eclectic background in psychotherapy, art, fashion design, neuroscience, technology, and startups. She's a co-founder of Interaxon, developers of the Muse, which is a brain-sensing headband. And she and her co-founders are on a quest to have a positive impact on humanity. She's here talking to us from Canada about how they're pursuing that quest through mind-controlled computer technology. Welcome, Ariel Garten.
Thank you. A joy and a pleasure to be here.
And you are speaking to me, you've just told me, from a cottage actually in Canada. Is that where you are right now?
Yes.
Enjoying the last little bits of your summer.
Soaking in the last summer. I hear it's your winter.
It is. It is, which is, you know, as we were just saying, off air, by contrast, nothing compared to a Canadian winter, although I am in the southeastern corner here in Australia. We did have a little bit of snow a couple of weeks ago, but it didn't last long.
When don't we have a little bit of snow in the winter? Technically, typically we're saying we have a lot of snow. And hey, there was just a little bit last week. How rare. Yep.
It was a highlight, a point of conversation for just about everybody in my town was the fact that we had some snow, because it doesn't happen every year. It's every kind of an every once in 5 year type event. Ariel, thank you. And I've given you a little intro there, but you do have an eclectic background. You have a wide and varied background. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be the CEO of a neurotech company?
Sure. So my background really is varied. I've sort of spent my life weaving between the arts and the sciences. My mother was an artist, so I was used to seeing, you know, people create out of nowhere on a blank canvas, just have an idea and make it come to life. I was really fascinated by the sciences and from a very young age really wondered how the world works, how you make things that shift people's perception and understanding, why tables are hard. And once I got through the fascination with how the world worked, I then became very fascinated with how we work. And that brought me into the field of neuroscience to try to understand the, you know, complex interactions of our brain that create our human behavior, our self, and our perception of the world.
Wonderful. So you're obviously a very curious child, you know, to be thinking those thoughts about how the world worked right from a very early age.
I was an incredibly curious child. And now that I have my own child who's massively curious about the world and constantly experimenting and figuring it out, I can see more of my perspective and perception at that age and how it all made sense to me. So I took all of that curiosity and trying to figure things out, and I was trained as a neuroscientist and then opened a clothing design company because I was also fascinated about fashion and how we create our identity and our personality. And then went on to be trained as a psychotherapist as another way to try to understand the internal self and how we can shift and change it. And then began working with an early brain-computer interface system in the lab of Dr. Steve Mann. He's one of the inventors of the wearable computer. So he had an early brain-computer interface BCI system with a single electrode that we were using to actually make music with the mind, as crazy as that sounds.
Wonderful.
Yeah, we would have a single electrode placed on our head, and by shifting our brain state, by focusing and relaxing, we could change the music in the room. And I stood back and said, like, oh my God, we're literally interacting with the world directly with our brain. We're able to take a part that's inside of ourselves and, you know, make it tangible, audible. The brain is typically a place that we have no access to, and all of a sudden we have access to it. Like, what can we do with it? And so I said, we need to take this technology to the world. So I formed a startup with Chris Ameny, who was an amazing, brilliant engineer who worked in Steve's lab. He was his master's student. And Trevor Coleman, a friend of mine who was great at promotions and business. And the three of us got together, you know, regularly in Trevor's basement trying to figure out what we would do with the technology and what it would become.
So Ariel, you strike me as somebody who, I mean, just for starters, moving from your initial training, starting at fashion and design, you actually had your own clothing brand, I believe, and a store.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep. Yep.
And then there's this just kind of leap into neuroscience and computing and technology. What kind of allowed that to happen, do you think? You know, what was it in you that helped you to jump just from one field to an entirely different field? Because I know that's the kind of thing some of us may dream about, but we always feel kind of limited in our ability to do that. What do you think made it easier for you?
One, I was very young, so I had no responsibility. you know, no fiscal responsibility, no family responsibility. Two, I had a deep belief in myself that I could do anything. So I was always kind of doing everything. I was always thinking like, oh, this is a great idea. Let's make it happen. And I knew nothing about technology, but that didn't really scare me or intimidate me. I simply partnered with somebody who was brilliant at it. And so I could like very clearly see that there is a future in which this technology was going to be really meaningful in our lives. And I had a background in neuroscience. So, you know, I was bringing the neuroscience side of it, but I was really bringing this vision of what this technology could be. And it didn't matter that I didn't have a ton of background in business. It didn't matter that I didn't know how to raise money yet. I just had this deep belief that I could figure it out. And it turned out that deep belief was really true. And I had this ability to just see something and inspire other people to come on board and do it with me. So it really didn't matter that I didn't know how to do everything. Thank God I didn't. I would have never been able to move forward if I tried to do it all myself. But I could just bring on board the people that I needed to. And I had an amazing team with my co-founders, Chris and Trevor, and the three of us were the initial little engine. And we could just kept, you know, engaging folks that were the right people to take us to the next level. And so if I had a, you know, single trait, I would actually say that I never had the inner critic inside me telling me I couldn't do it or it wouldn't be right or I shouldn't start. And so I think if there's one single trait, it is the mentality of possibility that just shone right through me.
And that really strikes me just as you were describing then that experience or what you think it is that's contributed to that. I think one of the things I love was that you said you didn't know how to do it or you didn't know anything about technology or raising funds yet. So that kind of yet type mindset of I don't need to be an expert in this yet. You know, there's lots of opportunities there to find, to discover, to learn, to grow and to do it, which is a real kind of mindset, isn't it?
It really was. And I think I just stumbled upon that naturally. And I, you know, ultimately raised $18 million in venture funds from venture investors in Silicon Valley and New York and Hong Kong. I really managed to go for it. I knew nothing about raising funds. I had zero formal business background. At one point, I thought I should go do my MBA, but I was so deep into the business that like, why waste my time doing that?
You're learning on the job.
Seriously learning on the job. And also recognizing when it was beyond my ability to learn. You know, you referenced that I was okay. CEO of a neurotech company, and I was for 7 years. And at that point, it became a company of, it was probably 45 people. And I looked around and said, oh, shit, I've never worked in a company myself. And yet I'm leading this first company.
You've grown
and
one.
We've done pretty well. And we're up to 45 people. And we had a product in Best Buy. And that's when the board sort of got together with me. And we're like, I'm really not the best person to continue to run this company. And so the gentleman who was my COO came on board as the CEO, and I stepped back into other parts of the business. So an important trait is knowing that you can learn everything you want and also recognizing when it's better off to hand the reins to somebody else who you trust and to be able to build trusting teams and relationships.
And that is, I know you do have a TED Talk that I have watched, and in it you talk about that notion of know thyself, which was Aristotle, I believe, the trait, I suppose, or the practice of self-awareness. So it sounds to me as though there has been a lot of that. You've been living that as well as speaking it in order to really unpack who you are and where your superpowers are. You know, that bringing people together, you mentioned working out what you're good at and then knowing where the limitations are to that. Would that be fair?
That would be fair. I think when I was young, I felt like I had no limitation. And as you grow, you discover your limitations.
Which is part of self-awareness, isn't it?
And necessity shows them to you. Yeah, which is totally part of self-awareness.
Fantastic. Okay. So by this stage, you've got all of this happening around you. One of the things that your organization was involved in was the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. And I think this is another wonderful example of that, just seeing possibility and perhaps not limitations and having a go at something huge. Can you tell us about...
This is the most nuts example possible, I think. So it's 2009. We are literally three people in a basement. Myself, Chris, Trevor, we We were literally in Trevor's basement. And we had this very early technology that allowed you to interact with stuff with your brain. And we thought, what's the biggest thing we could do with this? And we're like, we know the Olympics is coming to Canada the next year. We could use this technology to help have people control the lights on rings at the Olympics, the Olympic rings. And so I pulled a photo off the internet. We wrote a one page of some rings. We wrote a one page proposal talking about how people were going to control the Olympic rings with their mind. I didn't know anybody in the Olympics, but I knew somebody at a television station who was sort of tangentially a media sponsor. So I sent the proposal to them. And then by chance, at the same time, we were recognized by the Ministry of Research and Innovation, Canada's research and innovation arm. And they wanted us to do this installation for their big awards. And I said, hey, you're somebody from the government. You must know somebody from the Olympics. Can you just hand this proposal to someone from the Olympic side of the government, please? super naive. And we got a response back 2 weeks later saying, this is great. Can you do it in the province's colors? And that began this insane project where the three of us, with our entirely unproven technology that had only worked for a demo, you know, in the lab, we were commissioned to create a massive installation at the Olympics that was going to be Ontario or province's showcase at the Olympics. We were going to let people in Vancouver is in the west side of the country, control the lights on the CN Tower, the Canadian Parliament Buildings, and Niagara Falls. So these icons are about 2,000 miles away. And they were going to do them with their brain throughout the course of the Olympics. And so all of a sudden, we were saddled with this insane project on a very, very short timeline for a deadline that absolutely would not move for the Olympics. And somehow we pulled it off. Over the 17 days of the Olympics, 7,000 people got to individually interact with these massive icons, like the CN Tower is 1,800 feet up in the sky, and it has this insane 1,300 lighting system on it. And you could sit 2,000 miles away, focus on it, and be able to actually change the lights on the CN Tower just by thinking, by focusing or relaxing.
And so what were these people doing? Did they have like a headset on? Was it, what was the actual kind of apparatus that allowed them to then use their minds to change these lights on the other side of the country?
So they slipped on a little headset. At that point, there was actually another company who was making EEG devices and so we were able to use that device. And we created all the technology, the experience. It had to work for people across languages, so we couldn't even like use English to describe what to do. And people would spend 2 minutes training their brain on a small screen, focusing and relaxing, learning to actually see what goes on inside their own brain. And then they would go live on a huge live feed to one of the CN Tower, Canadian Parliament Buildings, or Niagara Falls, and then be able to literally interact with that massive icon with the lighting system on it directly with their brain. And it was extraordinary.
I can just imagine. I'm going to go back and look for footage now, and I'll certainly put that in the show notes for our listeners so that they can see as well. But I'm just thinking, you know, what struck me there is I'm visualizing you, three of you starting from a basement, and then you're literally on a world stage with this technology, with this idea that was just an idea that you had to pull together and prove very much in the public eye.
In the most public eye. We had, I think, 250 articles about us in multiple languages.
Incredible. So,
and it worked.
Yeah, which is, perhaps it's not amazing. I suspect from the tone of your voice that to you it felt pretty amazing that it worked.
No, it was amazing. It was insane that it worked.
That you pulled it off. So, and I, one of the interesting things about that, you know, for me as a psychologist is that, because I talk to lots of my clients and groups that I see about the notion of testing and learning. You know, I've got an idea, and whether that's a micro thing in their life or in your case, the most macro, this idea of having something and just thinking, you know what, let's just have a go, see what happens and what can we learn from that. And it sounds like for you, there must have been a massive amount of learning both through the process, but also it was really testing that philosophy that you had of we can do anything if we try.
Yes. And it was rather shocking that it actually worked, that we were able to pull together a team of people, that a team could even come together in such a short time to execute on this. It was also an incredible demonstration of the resiliency and the intelligence of the people around us, the team that we were working with. And ultimately, we stood back and said, wow, like we just pulled this off for the Olympics. We were on top of the world. We could do anything we wanted. And everybody was looking to this technology to see where it was going to go next. And that created an interesting moment for us because we're like, we have this great technology to control the light on big buildings. But how useful is that? Not particularly. You know, we did this thing that was so extraordinary, but actually not very practical or useful. And so we then set about trying to figure out what was the best application of this technology. And what we recognized was, as much as it's amazing to control the lights on things outside of you, to control technology outside of yourself, even more powerful is the ability to control the technology inside of yourself. And while we were teaching people on that small screen how to focus and relax and actually showing people what was going on in their brain, showing them that they were focused, showing them that they were relaxed, we recognized that that was the most important moment of what we did. Not that it was a massive building across the country, not that it was the Olympics, but that we're actually able to show people in real time what was happening in their brain. That we're able to take this intangible, untouchable, unvisualizable process that goes on inside of us and make it really tangible and practical. And we recognize that if we take that and bring it to the world, that's like understanding that there's an internal state that you can control and shift and manage and learn from, that then we will be doing something great for the world.
And that's so interesting. So the learning there, I suppose, for the three of you in all the possibilities of things that you could learn from that Olympics experience came back perhaps to finding something that felt meaningful to you. Would that be right? That really did feel like you were making a contribution to something important?
Absolutely. Because after the Olympics, we went on to make all sorts of silly things like thought-controlled slot car machines and thought-controlled beer taps and God knows what, the whole time trying to figure out what this technology could do and feeling really, as cool as it was, really unsatisfied by it because it was not making a meaningful contribution to people's daily lives. And it was finally when we hit upon this notion, it was really Trevor and Chris that identified it. And what we ultimately recognized was what we were teaching people to do essentially was to meditate. We were teaching them to focus and relax and shift internal state. And we deeply believed that if we could get more people in the world meditating, that we would make the world a better place. And it didn't really matter if the technology worked or not. It turns out it works phenomenally well. At that point, we're like, even if the technology doesn't work, if we can just get more people meditating, then we will have done something for the world.
Wonderful. And I love that just kind of meaning and purpose component of a project, to do something that really does give you a sense of satisfaction, to feel that you are contributing to something greater than yourself, and to be able to use your skills and the possibilities in order to do that. And I guess that means we're starting to talk about Muse and what it is. Can you tell us a little bit about Muse?
Sure. So Muse is a brain sensing headband that helps you meditate. So everybody knows that meditation is good for you. Everybody knows that you're supposed to be meditating, but frankly, most people don't do it because it's hard to do. You sit down, you're like, I'm going to meditate now. My mind's just going to go blank and it's going to be amazing. Of course, none of our blank minds ever go blank. They bounce all over the place. The person ends up being frustrated because you're like, you don't know what you're supposed to do. You don't know what's supposed to go on the black box of your brain. There's nobody there looking in your brain telling you what you're supposed to be doing during meditation. And you get frustrated and you get up and you don't do it. So we recognize that with this technology, we had the opportunity to literally show somebody what was going on in their mind when they were focused and when their mind was wandering. To be able to show them how to meditate and to be able to help you track the process to know when you're quote unquote doing it right, to see your improvement, to show you what to do. And at that, we could get more people meditating by making the process really obvious, tangible, and even enjoyable. So what Muse does is it tracks your brain while you meditate. So it's a slim little headband. It's like wearing a Fitbit, but around your forehead. And it gives you real-time feedback on your meditation by letting you know when you're focused and when your mind is wandering. And the metaphor uses your mind is like the weather. So when you're thinking, distracted, you hear it as stormy. And as you bring yourself to quiet, focused attention, it quiets the storms. So you have this really simple feedback where it's stormy and your mind's wandering, it's quiet and you're focused. And this really is able to very quickly guide you into a state of focus to keep you there. And then after the fact, you get all sorts of data, charts, scores, graphs, tell you what you're doing moment by moment and help you chart and see your improvement.
And I have been testing this myself. You kindly sent me a Muse and I have to say, I love it. I have that exact experience. And I do love that metaphor of the stormy weather. I think it really, you know, it's both soothing and indicative at the same time. So for me, as I sit there and I've got my headband on and it's connected to the app on my phone, so I put my headphones in as well, so I get, you know, the little introduction and then a description of, and it does calibrate as well just to make sure it's all working, so that's all good. And then, yeah, as you start, you can, and it's beautiful, gentle, soothing sound, weather sound. So even when it's stormy, it's not kind of aggressive stormy. It's just, you know, giving you an indication that your mind is wandering. And the first time I tried it, I was sitting there at home and no one else was home, so it was quiet, but there were cars occasionally passing. And I could notice that even if I got down to that calm state, so the weather was calm, and the wonderful little thing that kind of, it's almost a gamification type element of, when you get to a calm state, you start to hear the little birds chirping. So, you know, kind of satisfying feeling when you feel the little birds chirping. But I could sit there, and even if I got the birds chirping, I would notice, you know, I'd kind of somewhere in my mind hear the car go past. And then I'd noticed almost like a split second later that the rain would start to fall, you know, in the app, and I could hear that through the headphones, and I'd sort of go, okay, yeah, that's probably my brain just noticing that car, bring my attention back to my breath, see if we can get the birds to come back again. And another level of insight, as you described, you know, we don't know when we're meditating whether we're doing it right. You know, we can feel the effects if we're doing it well, but certainly if it's early in your meditation experience, you know, just kind of sitting there going, well, I don't know, is this how it's supposed to feel? I don't know if I'm doing this right. So being able to kind of get that instant feedback in such a lovely, soothing, almost sensory way, I suppose it is a sensory way, it's a hearing, you know, I found enormously helpful, even as somebody who has meditated on and off for a long time.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's very, very common feedback that we get. So it's awesome to hear that you had a wonderful experience with it. We find it's useful at various levels. So when somebody's never meditated before, Muse is a fantastic tool to just show you what to do. It just makes it really easy to start meditating. If somebody's a more experienced meditator, what it's doing is it's helping you enhance your metacognition. So as a meditator, what we're doing is we're observing the process of our own mind. We're noticing when it wanders. We're choosing to return it, and we're watching the whole process. So Muse brings your attention to things that you maybe wouldn't have even noticed, like a car goes by, and actually that has grabbed your attention for a moment. So you now have another level of observation and ability to see what goes on inside your mind and then continue to make choices about it. So it's increasing your ability to be mindful as opposed to just mindlessly sitting there.
Yeah, and I guess that is what it is. That I think I said to you off air just before we started that I've always, you know, even as someone, well, I've always felt a bit like a meditation failure in inverted commas, because I've never felt that I've sat down and done it consciously enough or rigorously enough or had enough of a routine around it. I have practiced yoga for about 18 years, so I think that has helped. And this is something that I, you know, talk to others about. If you're trying to establish or you're interested in getting into meditation, then just having those little micro moments of awareness of just noticing your breath or noticing what's going around and kind of building up the practice from there can be really helpful. So I discovered that I actually am perhaps better at meditating than I thought I was by using the Muse, because I could actually get into that calm state quite quickly. So that was very gratifying and quite motivating as well. You know, if you kind of feel like, oh, I'm better at this than I thought I was, I might keep doing it. But also, you know, as you say, for those novice meditators, people who are just wanting to try, to be able to have that kind of, you know, start with micro moments and then try the Muse out, you know, let it give you that feedback to tell you when you're doing it right, in inverted commas, you know, whether you're managing to calm your mind back is just it's an extra level of superpower when it comes to your meditation.
Yeah, and it really does like super hone your meditation. Because it's based on a focused attention on the breath exercise. So in focused attention on the breath, you focus your attention on your breath. Your mind wanders, which all our minds do. You then choose to return your attention back to your breath. And often when you're sitting there, it can be 1, 3, 5 minutes till you notice that your mind has wandered and you're on the grocery list. And if you're doing, you know, a 10-minute meditation, maybe you'll get 5 returns back to your breath during that 10-minute meditation, or even 10. And that act of noticing and returning, that's like the exercise of meditation. That's the bench press rep at the gym. That's the honing of the attentional loop. And so with Muse, you're instantly cued as soon as your mind wanders. So within, as you said, you know, half a second, very briefly, you're now notified that your mind is beginning to wander. So you can very quickly identify the wandering thoughts and become very sharp at honing that attention to your own thoughts and very quickly return. So within a 10-minute meditation, you could get 100 times where your mind has wandered and then you've noticed and returned. You know, essentially 100 bench press reps at the gym.
Yeah, I like that analogy. I'm actually practicing. I'm getting my brain fitter in terms of my attentional focus and my ability to come back to my breath and those mindful moments, the things that we know help to rejuvenate us. One of the other things that I noticed, Ariel, just as you were talking, it reminded me that I, in practicing, and I've tried using it at different times of the day, just to see whether, again, a bit of testing and learning to see whether there's a difference. And I had always been a bit in the habit of meditating before bed because I found it a relaxing thing to do, you know, improve my quality of sleep. But what I've discovered through using the Muse is that I'm actually better at bringing my mind or staying on task, I suppose, maintaining my focus on my breath in the morning than I am in the evening. In the evening, I get more stormy weather and I have more of those returns that you spoke about, which is probably good. You know, it's better training. In the morning, it comes far more easily, which was interesting feedback that I don't think I would have ever got via any other means.
That's awesome. That's really fascinating insight. And what we're doing, again, is we're honing our ability to notice the self and to understand the self, your changes at various points in the day. And, you know, what does that then change? Does it change your decision-making? Does it change your rituals before bedtime to help you calm that mind more effectively? We often hear people who meditate before they go to bed so that they can sleep more effectively. But we also hear a lot of people just love to do it in the morning because then it sets their day. And really what you're doing, whether you're doing it morning or night, is you're building the skill of meta-attention mindfulness that you then apply throughout the day.
Yeah, and I'm starting to think maybe, because I've always considered myself not a morning person, but I'm starting to, you know, at the age of 46, reshape my thinking on that another level of self-awareness. You know, maybe I'm actually better in the morning than I think I am, and maybe therefore I could reshape my day to make more effective use of that morning time. There's always those practical challenges of having children. I've got to get to school and the general chaos that goes on. But, you know, it is starting to change my thinking about how I use that morning time. Would I actually be more productive perhaps if I, you know, focused a little more on creative pursuits or elements of my work that require me to hone my attention more quickly and do that in the morning rather than the evening? I don't know. It's all an experiment.
Oh, that's amazing. You're potentially unlocking a superpower here.
You never know. It's going to be a big surprise for anyone who knows me, because I've declared myself not a morning person for my entire life. But, you know, we can all change and grow and learn even in our mid-40s.
In our middle life, yes.
Exactly, exactly. Ariel, have you had any feedback on, you said that, you know, there has been feedback from customers about how they use it. Are there particular groups of people? Do you find that this is something that really appeals to the new meditator, or are there people perhaps in certain professions who are using the Muse as a tool?
It's really across the board. We have literally hundreds of thousands of people that use Muse every day. It's been out now for almost 5 years. Believe it or not, I can't believe it's been that long. So we have people who've, you know, used it for like 1,000 sessions, really meditating regularly. Novices love it because it helps them start meditating. Experts also love it because it gives a new eye and a new insight into the practice. Clinicians love it. So doctors, psychiatrists, life coaches, chiropractors, naturopaths, anyone where you previously would have told somebody in their practice that you should meditate for whatever reason. So you'd recommend it to your patient. The patient goes home and of course never meditates because nobody really knows what to do when their doctor tells them to meditate and it's hard to stick to. The doctor, the clinician usually doesn't know how to meditate themselves. It's hard to teach. And now we're finding that in a clinician's office regularly, people just recommend or hand out Muses. Some of them have them on loan. Some of them, you know, will send a code online to purchase. And it just gets your patients meditating. So that's been actually a niche that we never imagined. Then we also have lots of studies with Muse.
That is a fascinating audience, I suppose, you know, client group, the use, because I can imagine for people that would be, if you are trying to encourage people to meditate, and as a psychologist, it's certainly something that I do and I know my clinical colleagues do, but yeah, giving them something practical and tool, and that kind of makes it a bit more fun too, if that makes sense, you know, a bit more engaging than just sitting there on your own. You've got a gadget to, you know, help you along. I can imagine that would be very appealing both to the clinicians but also to their clients.
Yeah, we've also seen it in schools. There is one study bringing meditation into grade 8 classroom, meditating with Muse, and they saw a 72% decrease in kids' sense of attention.
Wow.
So that was awesome.
Mm.
It's popular in colleges. Stanford uses it in one of their courses, two of their courses actually. MIT does as well. So they they give it to their students actually as part of the course. We see it in first responders. We have lots of athletes use it, literally NFL winning, Super Bowl winning football players that use it, tennis, skating, several soccer teams, Major League Baseball. So it's been wonderful to really see it adopted across the board and really just furthering the mission of bringing meditation into all of these areas where it may not have penetrated or stuck in the same way. So that's really the end goal, just get more people meditating. It will do so much good for the planet if we were just all meditate.
Rolling out on a global scale. And yeah, I can, again, you know, just thinking along the lines of that, you know, as a tool, a tangible tool that people can use, you know, there's certainly people in our population for whom, you know, a gadget is a wonderful thing. And if they've got something like that, you know, a piece of technology that they can use, that may well open their mind and their eyes up to actually engaging in meditation in a way that they might not have, you know, they might have perceived it as being. And I know when I'm introducing it as a concept often in workplaces, I say, you know, it doesn't have to be sitting cross-legged, you know, in the lotus position and going om. That's not what meditation needs to be, because there is a perception perhaps that that's what it's like or how you're supposed to do it, and that's very unappealing to some people. So to be able to use a piece of tech and say, you know, here it is and it's really cool, and by the way, you're going to learn to meditate at the same time, would just open up all sorts of possibilities for new audiences.
Yeah, we'll often find like mom who loves doing yoga will bring it home because she likes to meditate and, you know, loves having a meditation device. Then dad or boyfriend who's an engineer and hates meditation and would never in a million years think to do it, all of a sudden starts stealing it and using it regularly.
Yep.
Then teenage kids get on board and now they're meditating because they love the gamification and it's like playing a video game to them. And all of a sudden you've got the whole family meditating.
Yeah, perfect. And I must admit, that's exactly how I'm hoping it might roll out in my family, because I'm using it. And so I'm going to shortly encourage my husband to say, why don't you have a go? It's pretty cool. See what happens. And yeah, you know, I don't think the kids will be too far behind. I mean, meditation in itself has become, I'm sure it's the same in Canada, but already, you know, my children in primary school here, they do a little bit of meditation in some of their classes. They've been introduced to the concept of mindfulness even from preschool age. So, you know, I think, yeah, the possibility of, especially once I explain, yeah, that gamification element to it, see if you can make the birds come, will be very appealing to them. I've got two boys, you know, I think they'll be right on board with that.
Awesome. Also understand why meditation is really useful for you. I've got one boy, that's enough.
Yeah.
I get the delightful chaos that ensues.
Can be very full on, can get very noisy and very physical in my house.
It's awesome.
Hence the meditation. Ariel, what's next, both for the Muse, but also for yourself? Because, you know, we talked about this kind of mindset around futures and possibilities and all the amazing things that you might be able to do or that your organization and you call anybody might be able to do, really just that possibility mindset. What does the future look like for you and for Muse?
So with Muse, we recently came out with a new device, Muse 2. So everything that we've been talking about now is real-time feedback from the brain, but meditation is more than just the brain. So with Muse 2, we added a sensor to track the heart, the breath, and the body. So while you're meditating, you can listen to the beating of your heart like the beating of a drum, So you literally get to hear your own heartbeat and you tune your interoception, your ability to sensitively understand your own internal state. You can find stillness in your practice. For a lot of people, just finding stillness in your body is the first step to finding stillness in your mind. And then there's a breath sensor and guided breathing exercises so that you learn to manage your physiology. So that if you're in a situation where you're having anxious thoughts, you're feeling stressed, the first step is to learn to see what goes on in your mind, let go of the thought, return to a neutral object, take deep breaths and use your body and your physiology and your breath to be able to relax your body and guide you, tune into your heart and help it slow down and calm. And, once you begin to understand and work each of the systems in your body and understand how they work together as a whole, you have a much greater ability to have more choice and flexibility in how your mind and body react in different scenarios.
Amazing.
So that's Muse 2.
Yeah.
So that's been the next amazing journey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, having practiced yoga for a long time, that was how I sort of got an introduction, really, certainly from an experiential point of view, to mindfulness and meditation in terms of the mind, was actually that awareness that I got of my body and my physiology through the practice of yoga. So starting with the breath, but also, noticing where the tension in your body is, being able to breathe into a pose. So it really has been a mind and body experience, but it's taken 18 years of yoga to do that. And whilst that is something that I advocate for lots of people, this is obviously a tool to be able to do that so much more easily. And I'm wondering whether it would actually be really cool to use a Muse 2 while you were doing yoga. I don't know if that's possible, but to get all that feedback.
Yeah, it's something that we've looked at. You can't do the EEG stuff while you're moving because EEG requires complete stillness. But we've played around with tracking postures and using it for interaction with yoga. That's not something that's available commercially, but it's something that we've explored a lot internally.
So again, some future possibilities maybe.
Yes.
So yeah, that sounds wonderful. And again, lots of applications there. I'm thinking too, for people who perhaps experience anxiety, being able to kind of start to notice how you're managing your heart rate, how you're managing some of those physical symptoms that come with anxiety by getting that biofeedback and using that then in the practice of using your breath or other ways that you might try to manage anxiety. That sounds very cool. And it sounds like there's probably lots of other applications for Muse 2 as well.
Yeah, it's been really amazing and wonderful to see all the ways that people apply it and use it. And then it's also being applied just as a clinical grade EEG. So there's over 200 published papers using Muse either as a meditation tool or as an EEG device in neuroscience research.
Oh, incredible. Incredible. So making forays into the academic side as well as the practical side.
Yeah. I mean, we all come from the world of science. And so, ensuring that there's both scientific validity and the opportunity to move science forward through it has been both top of mind and so gratifying that it seems to be evolving in that way.
I can imagine. And beyond Muse 2, are there other possibilities at this point in time?
So the next thing that we're becoming interested in is sleep. And we have a good understanding of what happens with people during waking, and that's only half your day. And so we're now becoming very curious about what goes on during sleep. So keep your eyes open from us on that front.
I will. I'm fascinated by sleep. My mom has conjured, she's one of these kind of scientific curious thinkers as well. So she's got all sorts of theories about dreaming in particular and the changes that occur in dreaming over a lifespan. So she's in her 70s and she swears she dreams differently now and about different things than she did when she was younger. So who knows what the possibilities might be.
I'm curious, what has your mum shared about the changes in her dreaming, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, no, that's on mum's behalf. She actually asked me to ask an expert on this, so perhaps this is the opportunity to have that conversation. What she's noticed, if I can recall quickly, was that when she was younger, her dreams were more unrealistic, if that makes sense. They kind of just disconnected and weird and wonderful, the really kind of expansive, creative, weird sort of dreams. And she's noticed, and I think she said my dad had as well, they've obviously conversed about this, that as they've got older, their dreams have become far more practical. So they tend to be about real people, people that they know, things that have happened, things that are far more tangible. Now, that's a sample size of two. Who knows whether that's the case for other people, but it's just something that she has observed and is curious about.
So I'm going to answer not as an expert here, just as an average layperson coming up with some theories. Cool. So don't hold me to any of this.
No, of course not.
So one of the functions of dreaming is to consolidate our memories during the day. So when you're young, you have a very large neural space of possibility. When you're very young, you have a highly active imaginary world. You exist as much inside your head as you do out in the world. And some experts say that when you're young, your sort of locus of experience is very internal, not external, and because you don't have a fully developed model of the external world. And that's how kids have these amazing imaginations and imaginary friends and, you know, get scared of the monsters that are really just the pillows in the room. As you get older, your brain literally prunes and the space of neural possibility starts to decrease. You become fixed in the way that you understand the world and its interactions. And you also become fixed in your own pattern of interacting with the world. And in the brain, the more that something fires, literally the deeper the grooves get and the less, you know, branching tends to occur in our lives because we walk in very small paths. You know, we do the same thing every day. We brush our teeth in the same way. We have the same people that we like to talk to, et cetera. So the neural space of possibility tends to diminish, which is why as you age, you want to do as much as you can to try to expand that neural space of possibility by taking new routes home and learning new languages and, you know, constantly stimulating yourself with new information so you can try to continually build new connections and new ideas rather than limiting. And so if one of the functions of dreams is potentially to replay the events of the day, consolidate learning and consolidate those connections, when you've narrowed the space of neural possibility to a bunch of relatively well-worn paths, it seems far more likely that when you dream, those are the paths that you're going to be, you know, reactivating. And those are the kinds of memories, aka dreams, you're going to be having through the night.
There you go. And that makes absolute sense to me as another layperson. So if that's a layperson to layperson explanation, although that did sound like it came from somebody who knows a fair bit about this stuff. But that makes a lot of sense that over time, just because you don't have that kind of expansive possibility in your mind that, yeah, little kids do have, and then we're just replaying some of the same more well-grooved patterns as we sleep, hence the more practical dreams. There you go, Mum. If you're listening, there's the answer to your question. Or at least a possible answer to your question.
Oh, yes, preface it as a possible answer, an off-the-cuff theory. And I'd be curious as to what happened if your mother started to expand her input possibilities, if she would spend days, you know, staring at cool patterns and watching things on YouTube that she would never in a million years think of watching, and watching more surreal content and shifting the way that she starts to receive or look at the world, look at different art. Although if she's, you know, doing this intentionally as an experiment and thus it shifts her dreams, you have to wonder about the intention. You know, there's going to be a lot of, this is not going to be a clean experiment if she knows why she's doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Nonetheless, it would be interesting to discover if her dreams become more varied and fanciful through this process.
Yeah, look, that's a really good experiment. She is of a scientific nature herself, so she may well be keen to sign up for that. She's actually heading off from Australia to France to spend a couple of weeks painting. She's an artist herself, so, you know, with people. So it will be new surroundings, it will be new people, it will be a whole set of, I mean, she's done this sort of thing before, so it's not entirely new, but it's certainly not the everyday. So I will tell her to track her dreams during that period and see whether she notices any difference.
Awesome. And then to even push it further and, you know, look at artists that she's not used to looking at, like stare very deeply at paintings of artists that perhaps she doesn't even like and doesn't have an affinity towards, like see how she can mix it up in her own mind and see what the outcome is.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, she's got a homework task for holidays and we'll report back in. see what she's found. We do love a bit of self-experimentation here on the podcast. So, you know, we're just putting it into action.
Awesome. Also, your mum sounds awesome.
She's pretty cool. She's pretty cool. Ariel, what about for you? What does the future of possibilities hold for you, do you think, at this point?
I'm really enjoying being a mum. My little kiddo is 3, so a lot of my time and energy is really focused on drinking in this time and engaging with him and learning from it and having my own mind shifted and blown through the discovery of this tiny little person. And then what's beyond that? I don't know. Like, I'm very fascinated right now by approaching fears, and whenever I find anything that's fearful, I will go into it and I will feel it and I will wait till it cracks and I'll get to the freedom on the other side of the fear. So where that will lead me, I have no idea. And I don't think I need to know.
You don't. It's full of possibilities. Ariel, thank you so much for our conversation today. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I've learned a lot. I hope our listeners have learned a lot, and I hope they're inspired to practice their meditation and just to think about future possibilities as well. One of the things that we've been talking about a little bit on the show following an interview with James Garrett, who's a US-based psychologist also interested in neuroscience and neurotech, is this notion of our version 2. So, you know, who is Ellen Jackson 2.0, who is Ariel Garten 2.0, those future possibilities. And I hope that through the conversation today, because you've demonstrated just the power of possibility and having a go at things, I hope that that's inspired people to consider that as well. Ariel, if people want to find you or find out more about you, and of course find out more about the Muse, where do they go?
You can go to choosemuse.com. And you can find me on Ariel's Musings on Instagram and Ariel.Garten on Twitter. Now, just in that space of possibility. So that, to me, that's not an as well when you put it next to meditation. To me, meditation opens the space of possibility. So we're used to just...
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, we're used to just going through our rote thoughts, the thoughts that we're used to having, the brain that just has thoughts and the thoughts think us, and that's just the day that we have. But when you insert meditation into that process, what you're doing is you're giving somebody the opportunity to change the internal state, the opportunity to shift the thinking, to say no to the common thought that we keep having every day. And in doing so, open up an extraordinary space of possibility, open up the mindset of possible, shutting down the negative thoughts that hold us back, like the, I don't know, I won't, it's not good enough, it won't make me enough money, my mother won't like it, whatever. We finally have the opportunity to observe, change, shift those dialogues and open to whatever and whoever we want to be.
So it is absolutely integral to discovering our 2.0.
Yes.
It is. Ariel, thank you again for your time, and enjoy the rest of your holiday break. And for everyone who wants to find out more about Ariel, about Muse, about all of the things that we've discussed today, you can find them all in the show notes for this episode. But for now, we're going to say goodbye and thank you again.
Thank you. Total pleasure and a ton of fun.
How amazing is Ariel, and how cool was that conversation? I didn't expect to end up talking about my mum's dreams, but that's one of the things I love about podcasting, is that I never know where a conversation is going to take me, or you, as it turns out. To find out more about Ariel and Muse, pop over to the show notes for this episode, where you'll find the links and resources, everything you need plus more. That's at potential.com.au/podcast. And if you'd like to keep in touch with the podcast and everything that's going on in the world of potential psychology, you can subscribe to our newsletter at potential.com.au/subscribe. And if you think there's someone else who'd love the show and our guests, please tell them about it. You can do that in any way you like. You'll also find us on all the socials. Just search for Potential Psychology on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, wherever you like to hang out online. I'd love it too if you could rate and review the Potential Psychology podcast on Apple Podcasts. That is still the best way to raise the profile of the podcast so that more people can benefit from the wisdom, inspiration, and practical tips provided by our guests. Next week, On the show, we're talking about aging and aged care and well-being towards the end of life with an Australian psychologist who specialises in the field. Her name is Julie Badgick-Smith, and here she is to tell us a little bit more.
The impact of poor mental health in clients has much broader issues in terms of the workforce, their job satisfaction, and for families it's also quite difficult because they're seeing the changes in their loved ones' physical health but also emotional as well, and that can affect them in their own well-being. So if we look at the ways of how we can create mentally healthy aged care facilities, we're likely to see a broader impact of that in the entire environment.
That's next week on the Potential Psychology Podcast, a must listen if you have elderly or older family members or a personal interest in the latter years of life. I'm looking forward to being back with you then, but in the meantime, go forth, thrive, flourish, and fulfill your potential.